Hello and welcome to Dateline New Haven. I'm your host, Paul Bass. I welcome you to New Haven's home for community radio at 103.5 FM and live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. We have a special guest in the studio today from our brother city down the I-95, Bridgeport, Connecticut. A man on the campaign trail and running a city, Joe Gannon. Welcome to the studio, Joe.
It is my... I'm going to put this out there with a few appropriate adjectives. It's my distinct pleasure to join you, really, and admire you from over the years, but it's the first time I've been here with you, and it's enjoyable. So thanks. Thanks for being so gracious.
Thanks a lot, Joe. I'm going to ask you two things. One is to get real close to that mic, like you're almost touching it, but not quite.
All right. Try not to kiss it.
We got two... close though, and if we okay. we got two cups for you there. One is warm tea, and the other is cold water.
Oh, you're great. Thank you.
All right, Thank you. Joe Gannon, you're pursuing becoming governor in the 2018 election. You've been on the trail along with a whole bunch of Democrats because the lawyer is not running again for re-election. He's had two terms. Maybe learn the Roland lesson. I remember Roland when he started his third term, and he started getting in trouble. He said, "What was I thinking when I was going for term three?" But you got a big field there, Joe.
Yeah, it is. And I'm not discouraged or encouraged by the size of the field. I say to the groups that I speak to, those that are kind of the inside baseball in sports terms, the town committees when we talk to them like last night, I say it's good that we have a number of candidates, and I'll talk about the Democratic side, out there sharing views, sharing perspective, vision, ideas, so we can compare and contrast a little bit and get a good. And they're all impressive in their own right. Many of them are accomplished public servants. Some are accomplished in different fields. And so I think it's a good process, and I enjoy it. I actually enjoy more being at a place where the other candidates are. And when you get a chance to talk and go back, and forth, even if you're not debating, more than just kind of being on your own. So I think it's a healthy process.
My experience in covering politicians is that whenever they face an opponent, they get very upset about it, defensive about the opponent says, but that after a primary, they always say, this has made me a better, if they win, they say, this has made me a better mayor, made me a better representative by having to go through that process, and it's actually better for the city and for the party to have that.
And then what do they say when they lose? That was a terrible process. I got unfairly treated. But it is. It's like, you know, when you train for, like, it's almost like, I don't say primary is training because it's real, but you're right. It's that experience that... that is usually makes you focus more, understand differing views. And sometimes, by the way, in a primary, a party primary, sometimes the thing that your opponent says in that primary is not too far off from what something you may adopt later on that you didn't think about.
I watched that covering John DeStefano when he was mayor for 20 years. Almost every election, he would take an idea from his opponent, try to build a Long Wharf Mall when his opponent said that, some neighborhood development ideas, fixing the housing authority. There's always like one idea per election.
And there's nothing wrong with that. And even mayors kind of pride ourselves. We call it best practices. I'm sure a lot of professions or careers do that. But it's really just stealing ideas from each other, you know? What's Chicago doing? Oh, my goodness, they did this great thing for parking. Let's do that. They, you know, they went in this direction or that direction. And you look at it and you adapt it and, you know, with attribution or without, it doesn't really matter.
Joe, can you think of an idea an opponent once had against you that you incorporated as mayor?
I will tell you something that I adopted from now someone I guess you could consider, and I don't really consider him an opponent, but someone who's also a candidate for statewide office, is transparency, which I talked about during my run this time for mayor. But Kevin Lembo has put the state, it's called Open Connecticut. So all the books of the state of Connecticut are out there. And we tagged on his, thanks to his leadership, frankly, to do Open Bridgeport, where we put the Bridgeport's books, its budgets, online so that it could be the most open and transparent city government, and I believe, no disrespect to anybody else, but I think the most open and transparent in Connecticut and maybe beyond. So that kind of thing happens, you know, by understanding that, hey, wait a minute, somebody really spent some time and energy on this, and it can benefit my, in this case, my city or my constituency as well.
It's like folk music. Nobody owns the melody. No one owns the idea.
Right.
So now, as you mentioned, Kevin Lembo is among those pursuing a possible gubernatorial bid on the Democratic side. There's also a big group on the Republican side, but you got Dan Drew, the mayor of Middletown. You got Jonathan Harris in West Hartford. You got a bunch of other people. In terms of distinguishing yourself from the pack, is it fair to assume that you're going to be running as an urban mayor who understands cities? Is that kind of going to be the shtick?
Yeah, I smile because distinguishing me from the pack is usually not that, it's not going to be that challenging in certain instances, just because of my profile generally. I say that kind of, you know, a little bit off of the typical topics that you would run into in a crowded Democratic field, and, you know, with someone more progressive or they're less progressive, you know, that kind of thing. But in fairness, so this morning, for instance, I was at the Middlesex Chamber of Commerce event, it's the football coach from UConn was there, and he was the key speaker.
And so I'm going to ask you a little closer to the mic.
And Dan Drew was there, and Dan, of course, is Middletown, so he was, you know, he spoke and he did an intro and gave a key to the city, but, you know, graciously acknowledged me in the audience, which he didn't have to do. So I guess what I'm saying is, yeah, there's ways to distinguish, but there's an awful lot of common. I'd like to hope that it continues.
So the way to play nice is you're not putting anyone else down, but you're honestly trying to say something that makes you best for the job.
I think that's right. I think
that is running a city. So Dan Malloy ran Stanford. In general, and tell me if I'm wrong about this, because you know more about Connecticut politics than I do. Historically, I don't think mayors have done that great from bigger cities running for governor, but an exception was Dan Malloy. And he said, I had experience administering, you know, it's an executive job, mayor. It's not a legislator job. Are you making some kind of similar pitch that your stewardship or Bridgeport is a record that you can transfer to the state level?
Interesting. I didn't initially go out to make that pitch. But what I found was in talking to people and just going through some of the things that we're doing, and I got that is what seemed to bleed out or seemed to come out of some of my presentations. People raise a question and say, you've obviously got the most experience. I mean, you've run the state's largest city. At one point, you took it from bankruptcy. You know how to balance budgets. You held the line on taxes for 10 years in a row. You've done these different, led the question with, you've obviously got the most experience. And I started thinking to myself, geez, you know what? They're right. There's nobody else in the field that has the type of experience.
Right, and the question is what kind of experience you need for governor. I remember when Toby Moffitt was a former congressman, kind of very controversial liberal congressman, when he ran for governor against Bill O'Neill, I believe it was 86, he didn't get that far, but Stanley Greenberg, the pollster, did a poll, and they said that voters want their governor to be a banker, not a fire thrower, and he tried to be a banker and obviously didn't work.
No, you
but
can't.
But that executive skills are more important than advocacy skills for an executive.
I think that's right, consistently right. But I think in the time frame that we're in right now, I've seen the emphasis being on, because of where we are with the state budget, for instance, where it's far from perfect, it's far from settled, let's just be kind in our terms, probably almost deceivingly kind, it's a mess. That they look more towards what I'm hearing is, geez, if you got the experience, you can get up there. Why would you, to the extreme question or framing of why would you want this job? The state's bankrupt, or the state's in, and rings a bell to me, saying kind of what we took over at one point in, you know, the state's largest city in Bridgeport. So interesting. I think the timing on...
Right, your predecessor the first time around was Marianne Moran, the immediate predecessor?
Yes.
And she had pursued the idea of declaring bankruptcy, but never did, right?
No, actually, she filed in federal court, was the largest municipality in the country at that time to file for federal bankruptcy protection, trying to break union contracts, pensions.
And what happened with that?
What happened was they had a full hearing before the bankruptcy court. It was opposed by the Attorney General's Office of the State of Connecticut, in effect. The court said that there was a standard, I just paraphrase, maybe not 100% accurate, that you have to show that you can't pay your bills as they become due in a certain time frame. And Bridgeport had not demonstrated that. So the challenge with it is, without getting too much into the legalese, is the counter argument can be made. I'm not sure this was the prevailing argument in Bridgeport's case, but the argument can be made, whether we like it or not, as public policy or decision makers, that, wait a minute, you do have the authority to raise more revenue, whether you think it's a point of diminishing return or not, is the difficult argument to make. In other words,
you have to prove to a judge the theory that if I raise taxes in Bridgeport, we'll get less money because people will go broke and just not pay their bill.
That would be the argument Hartford would have to make too.
Right, because right now they're looking at bankruptcy.
And so, you know, you get to that point where you know it's bad public policies. You know that people are going to, you're going to hurt people that can't afford it. Maybe two family homes, maybe people don't have money. You know you're going to hurt those people if you raise them. But does that, and it creates an interesting...
Rise to a legal standard threshold. But it does rise to remind you, listening to Dateline New Haven and WNHH Radio FM, your home for Community Radio New Haven at 103.5 FM, live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. We're visiting with Joe Ganim, the mayor of Bridgeport, and a contender for the 2018 Democratic gubernatorial nomination. So why would you want the job of running a state that currently has a $5.1 billion two-year projected deficit? The legislature has not produced a budget 2 months almost now after they had a deadline to do so. Why would you want that mess?
Well, it's certainly not the mess that anybody wants, but I do think I have a skill set, and whether I like it or not, experience, good and bad, of understanding challenges, certainly as a chief executive or as a mayor.
And what you're saying with this bankruptcy, because we didn't really finish that idea. So you came in.
I came in, I withdrew it. I withdrew. Weicker was governor. I withdrew it. And I said, look, I've got a same approach I would try and do with, and hope anybody would do with any problem, at least in general terms, is how do we, not I, how do we fix this? And what role do I play? Am I an integral role in every aspect of this? Am I a leader? Or am I a follower on parts? Am I a bridge builder as opposed to a divider? And what we did at the time was, and I worked with the governor then, I worked with labor leaders, I worked with business leaders. We sat around the table as opposed to across the table and renegotiated millions of dollars worth of savings, and we're able to capitalize on...
You're talking about with unions?
Well, with unions, yeah, with employees, with management in the city, on healthcare, for instance. Around union contracts that were challenging and were part of the projected escalating costs.
So let's fast forward that today. Let's say you were the governor today, Joe Ganim. You're in Dan Malloy's position. He has renegotiated with unions. First of all, do you agree with the deal he came up with there?
Well, I'm still looking at it. I am glad. I think it's an integral part in putting what is now the next 2 years on track. It's substantial savings. So I think it's a good thing.
But it's less than half of the $5.1 billion they need to make up.
I think that's right.
So would you raise revenues? That's really the key question. The legislative Democrats want to raise the sales tax. In today's political environment, you always have to kind of sneak revenue enhancements. You have to call them that instead of taxes because people always say no taxes.
I guess.
Would you have the guts to raise revenues?
Yeah, I guess you really have. I think you got to look at both. If you're really in that situation, you have to look at both sides of it and you have to make difficult decisions. Exactly what they are at this point, as far as what revenues from a distance or what expenditures have to be cut, I think it's hard to identify because I take a step back on a couple fronts. One is, and we're looking at this now, and you can fault me for not having the answer, but I'm just going to be, you know, blunt about it. What is it that got us to the point where we're off by some $2 billion on revenues and expenditures for the next 2 years? In other words, what were the assumptions
and
that
the
were
theories
made?
Were that, and this might be wrong, is that we had pension obligations we haven't been meeting for years because a bad deal struck and budget decisions made back to the Roe administration, that we relied heavily on a progressive income tax, which was good, but that because income is so fluctuating in your county, Fairfield County, especially not in Bridgeport itself, but where the hedge funders all live, that there was a lot less income than projected quarter after quarter among the wealthiest taxpayers who were paying the most on the income tax.
That may be. I'm not convinced of what all the elements are or were, but that has been a well-floated theory. And, you know, Wall Street Journal, I'm told, although I didn't actually see the editorial myself, said that there were X amount of, let's use billionaires, I don't think millionaires are that, you know, they're all too common, I guess, moved out and have all taken up residence.
So now the Democrats really go against that idea. They say if you look at New York, you look at Massachusetts,
right?
They actually have higher income tax rates than we do on billionaires,
right? And why then do some of these corporations do the GE and the Aetna thing? Which is, I don't mean to be cute about it, but why does a GE decide? And again, the answer is I think
to go to a higher tax state.
Higher tax state.
So what's the answer?
Well, I don't know. My answer for now is this. Between that and Aetna, and missing revenues and projections and how we got there is we're doing something wrong. And this is not to cast blame. It's not like elected official A or B or anybody. It's something's just needs to be changed dramatically. Some of my ideas are back to what you mentioned in two or three questions ago, is I do believe, and maybe it's just from being an urban mayor, that we can change the dynamic, I think, by a greater emphasis on job creation in our center cities, knowing what cities want and need, and one of them is not to have the highest tax rates, mill rates in the state, not to have the lack of funding despite all that, because we house and need to provide for some people who have the greatest needs and some of the greatest services.
But more state support for center cities can help engine for job creation. That would help us with
job creation, where cities, I like to use the term, where the cities become the engines that drive, that drive Connecticut's economy, as opposed to being, you know, something that is always lacking self-sufficiency and looking for support. And that doesn't mean we don't support Hartford, Bridgeport, New Haven. Absolutely, we do that. But with a dynamic that I think I've yet to articulate.
So let's talk about specifics. How do you make cities the engine? So some people argue GE went to Boston because they wanted to be at a place that, in fact, the state had supported as a hub for innovation, investing in the research triangle there with MIT and or Route 128, and that he wanted to be the head of GE wanted to be at a place where there's some creative interchanges. They go to more of a technology company. Governor Loy addressed that through the first six. Is that what they call them? First, it was the first five, and the first six, you give big tax breaks to companies to locate in center cities. And one of them was Lexion in New Haven, which did create 100 jobs, but now is kind of on the ropes because of scandals with how they had business, set the business practices. Is that the way you boost job creation in cities?
Well, I don't.
State tax breaks to lure companies?
So, there's a lot of ways, and that's the way that's been proposed, and hopefully it's successful, and it's probably, there has been and will continue to be successful with those that are identified and targeted by the administration, no question. Well, I don't know, no question, but that's the goal. Mine would be a little bit more, I don't want to say in an unflattering term, generic, or in a more flattering term, general and consistent, where I would look at a more focused policy that impacts and is understood up front, not on a one-off, but on a consistent policy, let's say for the urban centers. Let's use the four or five or six or seven, as many cities as you want to incorporate into it, that says this is what we would do, this is what we will do, and this is our policies, whether they're financial incentives, whether they are a regulation tailored aspects, whether they are job incentive elements, and I'm sure it includes all of these, and this is how it works. So I would use it to compare to something I did on a local level, or what we're doing on a local level, because frankly we haven't done it yet, is we've attacked this incentive for individual businesses when they come in and say, well, we want to locate a business in Bridgeport, Joe, and we want to create 10 jobs, 50 jobs, 100 jobs. And we need, you know what, the deal's a great deal, but we need a tax break. We need a payment in lieu of taxes. Or we need, and what the policies have been consistently is, okay, what do you need? Let's figure it out. Let's go to the city council, see if they'll approve it, and we're going to make your deal work for you. Rather than that, we're putting into place an ordinance or a local law, regulations called ordinance, that says this is what it's going to be, and it'll be consistent for everyone, and we'll promote it. We'll tell them, look, if you come in, this is what we have. And it's an incentive package.
For instance, even if you're going to build where a place is not built up now and the value of the property is going to increase, it's a phase-in for 5 years.
Could be. Could be a phase-in for 5 years or 10. I don't know what the element.
But are you saying the state policy be more toward smaller businesses rather than just the first five or six, the largest employers?
Oh, I think you have to do both. It's not as glamorous, and this isn't saying that the big ones aren't important. When you lose a GE, and when you have an Aetna, the ripple effect of it is, you know, and we need to work back from this, gets caught up in conversations like this, where you start challenging, you know, in a good sense, you start saying, wait a minute, why do they leave? But in a bad sense, it's like, wait a minute, they're leaving. That's not a good signal for our state. So we need to recognize that in the big ones. But the small ones create, if you were able to look at them, and it's a lot more work, you know, the 50s and the hundreds of employees and the salaries that are not your Wall Street salaries, let's call them, from down in Fairfield County, they make up the backbone of the men and men, the working individuals' jobs in Connecticut, certainly centered around in many ways our city. So yes, you have to do both, and I think there has to be an understanding for me, anyways. And I just put my own, you know, shortcomings out there. I would bring in, if we're able to do it, some of those biggest, if they participate, and I think they will, smaller, medium size, whether it's CEOs or the key people that understand the dynamics and will share it with us. I'd bring in some of the brains that we have, and I don't think you have to go all the way to Massachusetts to find them. I think we have them at UConn, at Yale, at UB, at Fairfield U, at all of our universities that understand the dynamics of the economy, and public officials, whether it's legislators or executives, and have that discussion, whether it's an hour, 2 hours, a half a day, 2 days, 3 days, and maybe come out with some ideas. I think I know some of them, but I think they know more.
And then on very specific, just to get narrower ideas about how to close that budget gap, let me just give you rapid fire a couple of ideas on the table. One is to legalize marijuana.
Right.
Yes or no?
No, I didn't say yes or no.
I'm asking yes or no.
Oh, so I think I'm going to answer the same thing to all of them, at least at this point. I think you got to look at them all. You got to look at how much money it generates. Public policy, that one I think has become much more acceptable than it was, let's say, a decade ago. And depending on how much money it brings in, I think you have to look at it and see if the General Assembly will support it. And same thing probably on tolls, if that's your next one.
Yeah, that's my next.
Okay. No, I mean, these are elements. Where if you're picking up $100 million.
Are you inclined to say yes?
I'm inclined to say yes on those, yes. Because again, why are we doing it? Are we doing it because we want to change the dynamic of how marijuana is treated? Well, that doesn't necessarily drive me. It doesn't bother me so much. Is it, if we're looking at a way to support state government so we can provide the needs of people across Connecticut, like people that were up at the General Assembly or at the Capitol yesterday saying, hey, wait a minute, we have challenges, we have needs that are not being met by social service agencies, by state government, by local government, and we need to meet these needs. Those, to me, start to push us over the edge of the envelope and say we need to make some hard decisions for revenues to support these things.
Another idea for revenues was the carried interest loophole. So now a hedge fund manager in Fairfield County, instead of paying 39.6% federal income tax on his income, he pays 20% because he calls it carried interest. There's a movement among state legislatures nationwide, not from the Koch brothers, but from the opposite group at lobbies, to close that gap with state revenue. So they're getting away with 19% of tax they're not paying. Make that a state levy on carried interest. What do you think?
I'd have to, what I know about it is not much more than you just described. So, but those are the type of things where I think you look at them, you look at the impact, what is it going to do, and then you look at how much revenue it brings in, and you make a tough decision. And at some point, you've got to close that. Whoever's the executive, whoever the legislator. These are the type of decisions we're going to have to, unfortunately, pull together. Because otherwise, and you talk about raising taxes or not raising taxes, right now we're looking at the potential of forcing cities and towns, not just the biggest cities, to be in a situation where they don't have enough or we don't have enough revenue coming from property taxes, which is the most regressive. So that's part of the discussion. I know it's not being...
Well, when you ran for Governor Bill Curry, property tax was your main plank, if I remember correctly.
I think there was property an element of reducing, looking at, we're one of the highest in the nation, which we probably still are, in reliance on property taxes to fund education, public education, and local government. And it's having a, strangling effect. I can probably remember some of the phraseology that was used at the time, and it's still true. Struggling and strangling. Look at Hartford, and the mayor's doing a tremendous job. You've got a great mayor.
Would you bail him out? Would you do the $40 million bailout?
I would help Hartford. I would do anything we need to do to help our cities not only survive, but to flourish so that the needs of all the residents of that city, when I pick the impact, all the surrounding towns and the state as a whole. So, yes, I would do everything we could to help. Absolutely.
And what about single-payer health insurance? That's a proposal on the table that some of the Democrats have embraced in the run for governor.
I think that presents an opportunity as well. I think we've got to look at anybody that says that we shouldn't look at this, we shouldn't incorporate that into the discussion, I think is selling short.
So Zach, you say your position is you're not endorsing any one new form of revenue, but you're keeping an open mind on all of them and saying it's got to be on the table.
Absolutely. And as we go forward, I think, in fairness to the discussion, I will.
You're going to have to get more specific by the time the election comes. We got a year and a half.
Yeah.
A little more than a year. But we also got to remind people that are listening to Dateline New Haven and WNHH Radio. You're home for community radio at 103.5 FM, live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. We're talking to Joe Ganim, Mayor of Bridgeport and candidate for governor. So you've done an interesting lawsuit in your candidate for governor.
Yes.
You are challenging a rule in a federal lawsuit by the Citizen Election Program. That's our clean money fund that candidates who choose to opt in can get matching money for the run for governor when they raise money if they reach a threshold, so they have more money to run with and it can have more people running. You have been barred from that program because of the 7 years you spent in federal jail on a public corruption charge, and you're saying that that is unconstitutional, that you would be barred as that result?
The system is great. I've said, please let me participate in the system. What happened was not the system that's being challenged at all. The system's being supported. In fact,
it's this one rule in the system.
It's an amendment. It's an amendment that came years later. An amendment that I think flies in the face of the intent of the legislature.
Now, was this about because of Ernie Newton's?
It might have been. It was definitely prompted by something. But even comments and I've been told by the League of Women Voters saying, "Wait a minute, this amendment isn't really what this is about. It's not to keep people out. It's supposed to bring people in, so that if you're going to have a public funding system that takes the need to, you know, reach out to big donors as was the case in the past, out of the system." Then you want people in the system. You don't want to take them out for any reason. So that's in federal court.
Tell me if I got the two philosophical arguments right. On the one hand is the argument that we become a second chance state, that we're saying whether it's voting rights or getting hired for a job, so many people have been spending time in jail. We had a period of high incarceration that we're going to be, democracy loses and our economy loses if people don't get a second chance after they've done their time. And that the argument on the other side is there's this different bar for politicians when it comes to public money. If you've gone to jail for violating the public trust and have a record of misusing public money, the public trust, you shouldn't get the extra advantage of taxpayer money to run. And then the argument coming back would be that's not an extra advantage. It's the idea of having a wider selection of people to choose from. Is that a fair way to characterize the debate, and how would you respond to that?
Yeah, I don't know if you obviously very articulate on the point. A couple things I would probably tweak a little bit, but generally I think for the listeners, let's just say yes.
So how do you respond to that?
So yes,
Joe Ganim, you violate the public trust, why should we give you money to run again?
Well, but that's, so I would say that I'm somewhat of a unique case. I don't say unique, but certainly a small number. I've been given the honor of being reelected to run the state's largest city. I'm a public official. The people of Bridgeport, and I think hopefully made the right decision. And hopefully the work that we've done since I've been reelected will bear out that they did, that we've moved the city forward, that we've been a good steward, not only in transparency, but in the public trust of doing what a public official should do. So that's the interesting thing about this is there's been some rules that say, hey, wait a minute, if you don't want someone who has a felony conviction to be in public office, you could actually bar their right to vote, which we in Connecticut, I think rightfully so, have said, no, we don't want to bar someone. We believe in redemption, my term, but we believe in second chances. We believe in the opportunity to rehabilitate. If you look at criminal justice system, I like to believe that certainly there's a penal or a punitive aspect to that. In other words, you want to punish people. But I think more importantly, society, I'd like to believe, and again, this is just me talking, but I think hopefully people, majority agree, that there's a rehabilitative aspect to it. If you really want to have a better society, you want to rehabilitate people.
Should that be the province of public financing? Because that's part of the question here I think I see, and I actually personally don't have an opinion on it. I tend to be a second chance person.
Yeah.
The argument being made by the proponents of that law is this is an extra benefit gift given for people with the public trust. Public money to run for office is different from regaining your right to vote.
No. I think that I think the intent was, and I think the legislative history would bear that out. The point of it was to create an atmosphere where elections could be done. Nobody wanted to use public money. That's like the last resort. But it was the avenue whereby they would take out the element of large donors having that one leg up.
And have less corruption in government.
Right. So therefore...
The catch-22 is, do you get less corruption in government by allowing everyone to run, including someone who had in the past been convicted of corruption?
Yeah, but doesn't say all people have to do at that point is vote against or vote for the candidate they want.
So more democracy. More choices.
So I'm not asking anybody to vote. All I'm saying is a level playing field. If you don't want to give anybody public money, don't give anybody public money. How do you give a guy $6 million? How do you give say somebody likes me, God forbid somebody wants to vote for me, right? And they like me. And my opponent gets $6 million. What's that vote? Wait a minute. This is a fair. I can't. What's Joe Ganim got to say as opposed to, and it doesn't have to be me.
Let me ask
anybody.
You this. Can you turn around to an advantage the fact that you experienced the criminal justice system? Like when you ran for mayor again, you were in prison, you came back, they elected you again in Bridgeport. And one thing that was clear in the black community was that people responded to your point that people deserve a second chance after they've been in prison. You had them reelected. You have them getting back in the voting rolls. Some voters didn't even know they could do that. Is that a theme you can pursue as a governor candidate? Is there a story you can tell about what happened to you being in prison and coming back?
Sure, of course there is.
What is that story?
And for me, it you know, and for anybody who's had an experience in a life where they're not on top of the world, let's say, for lack of a, where you've gone through a difficult time, I'm very careful about what would be personalizing and putting something out there politically. I don't feel comfortable, frankly, saying, oh, this is great, let's put this out because this is the political advantage. What I will tell you is this. Everybody has things in their life. I haven't started yet, but I'll probably use the term at some point. I haven't walked into a room yet where somebody hasn't made a mistake, small or big. Mine were not small, don't get me wrong. And they're perfect. And there's people that understand the ability to accept responsibility, which I've done, and to say, wait a minute, you don't have to. And I say to people, when I talk to them, I did all these, in a paraphrase in kind of a corny way, I did all these great things, you know, as mayor. And I want to say it like that because it really, but we worked, and these are the accomplishments that were made while I was mayor, I think is a better way to put it. And by the way, this is what happened. And you need to know what happened in case you don't, in case you weren't reading the paper. And I have a felony conviction. And you know what? If that's a non-starter for you, despite whether you think I'm the most experienced, I have the best vision, and I can really put Connecticut back on track, it's okay. And I'm wide open, and I say it like this. If you have questions you want to ask me about this afterwards, publicly, privately, pull me aside right now about my that I'm open for that. I put myself out here as a candidate, so you can do that. And by the way, if you think at the end of all this, that just because of that alone, that's a non-starter for you, it's okay. There's going to be some people that feel that way. But I also give them the opportunity in that conversation to say, but if you think after looking at all the candidates and you evaluated me talking to you right now, or my experiences and the things that I think I can do for Connecticut with the positive things I've done, maybe you do believe in second chances. Maybe you've had, and God forbid you have something in your life where you think that a second chance would be something that could really allow you or a family member or friend, then think about that. Think about it.
Did you learn anything from that experience about the effect of money in politics? Now, this is very one interesting aspect of your campaign, and it's true when you ran for mayor again, too. You ran on creating public financing, if I remember correctly.
We couldn't get it going, but I tried.
But is there anything specific you could say about the crimes that led you to end up in federal prison? Did you, when you were sitting in prison, what did you think about money in politics, and how does that affect what you're doing
now? Yeah, there is a whole element of politics in this. In the United States, I think people have recognized it, that where you can take the element of fundraising, minimize it, eliminate it, and allow people, the candidates who have good ideas, to get out there and talk about this. They've tried it on a presidential level. Sometimes it works. It doesn't. With the, you know, those are the signature cases. We've seen it in Connecticut. I think it allows, in this case, it may allow three or four candidates on the Democrat side, three or four candidates on the Republican side, to run, to be viable candidates for the state's highest office, where otherwise they may not be able to do it because it's so hard. But the other thing I was going to tell you about the second chance, what I found going around Connecticut was, and it's not just in you know, people like, oh, that's just in urban centers. You know, you have certain groups that maybe are more open to that. I found in talking to individuals in small towns where you might think, you know, gee, they're going to give you a head fake as soon as you mention that. They're going to say, oh, well, okay, nice talking. I got to get a cup of coffee. I've had people come up to me, you know, an example of a school teacher taught sixth grade afterwards, and I didn't know what she was going to say. She said, I want you to know that was actually inspiring. This, your willingness, she used the word, you know, courage or something, to come back after all that, to take on whatever it took on, to stand up, dust yourself off, and try and make a contribution. Again, I'd love you to come talk to my sixth grade class, because I have kids in there that are running up against this all the time. And I was like, wow. I said, I didn't really understand that the people could make a connection just on what I had said on that. I thought it was like, let me get through this part. Let me explain to people so that they understand it. And so there is elements in people's lives that you don't know anything about that I don't know anything about. Maybe it's, in this case, a school teacher or someone that's gone through stuff. And I've had so many people pull me aside when I say, look, you need to know something, and they say, they want to tell me something that in their life is as compelling to them as what I went through was compelling to me. In other words, whether it's tragic, whether it's, you know, life-changing or whatever. So there's an interesting human aspect to that that I'm not afraid to share. I'm not afraid to discuss.
Why do you think John Rowland ended up in jail for corruption? He came out and he performed crimes again that got him back in. How psychologically, how that happened? You knew John Rowland. You were, you know, you operate in the same state. What did you think when you heard that?
I have no, you know, it's hard for me to get into anybody else's mind. I do know that when I came back, I had no preconception about wanting to do anything but put my life back together. And I'd been way
But you're
a long
willing
time.
To go in politics again, which is dangerous waters.
No question.
And it puts you at risk of going back to jail again. You know that the feds, they created a new corruption unit. They're going to be watching everything you do.
As they should. No.
But what's, I can't, when I've talked to other people who've gone to jail, the thought of going back to jail is horrifying to them.
No question.
So as you talk about getting other people's head, as a reporter, I always try to put my head in the people I cover. So right. I would never be in politics. I'd never run for office.
Smart.
But
you're
I'm
smart
convinced
man.
That even though I believe I would never steal or do anything wrong, I'm convinced that if I were a mayor or something like that, I would end up in jail. Because I watch about how difficult, sometimes it's out and out theft. Like someone knows, like I'm not going to name the name. There was a mayor in the 90s who said, who actually wrote a note, everybody else is making money in development. What about me? And they leave the money in a newspaper. But there's a whole other realm of taking a necktie or trying to solve a problem for your city where you honestly believe it's going to be easier to get this building built or this flooding problem fixed if this guy just talks to that guy and this guy happened to give you money, but you think he's good at fixing a problem. I consider politics a treacherous business in terms of always having the danger of going back to jail again. And I'm wondering if that your experience gave you a way to reflect on that when you do or don't take a present or how you do and don't fix a problem.
Yeah, of course. And we've tried to, I think, be even more attentive to those type of details with all of that. And hopefully there are people that we've got in place in local government and that they give advice to the campaign as we go forward. But you still do fundraising. We do it above board, straightforward, very conscious about all the elements of it, and certainly want to be in the, it's one of the.
And if you get in the citizen election program, you can't take money from people who do business with the state, correct?
You can't take it anyways.
Oh, okay.
Or even if you're not in the system. So there are some built-in issues. One is if you're a state contractor. If you're on a state contractor, it licks your
bar. Oh, it's PACs you can't take the money from. So if the contractors give money to a PAC, if you're in the citizen election program, I believe you're not allowed to take PAC money.
I think you're right on that. I know that's true
with the city program in New Haven. Yeah,
yeah, I have to confess it's very complicated on the whole system. But I'm pretty sure state contractors are no, you can't. PACs, I think you're 100% right on that too. And lobbyists are limited, probably on both fronts. In other words, if you're in the system or you're not in the system. So they put some systems in place that reduce who can contribute, the number of people in that can and can't. But the opportunity to participate in the system is the best opportunity for all of the candidates, I believe. And there's an editorial by Ed Marcus in the New Haven Register today, which basically says, regardless of how you feel about it, you know, you should let, you can't, how do you give money, $6 million to one candidate and not another candidate?
Wouldn't you hope that when you're in your 90s, you'll be writing op-eds in the newspaper and playing tennis?
I would love to.
And yes. Listening to Dateline New Haven and WNHH Radio, your home for community radio at 103.5 FM, live stream at newhavenindependent.org. Bridgeport Mayor and Governor candidate Joe Ganim. Joe, one of the big issues is sanctuary cities and sanctuary states. So Donald Trump has promised to take federal money away from cities and states that don't have policies to cooperate with local enforcement, with federal law enforcement in identifying and detaining people here who are undocumented. And having policies like sanctuary city politics in New Haven, we've been letting people stay in churches when they're supposed to be deported. What's your position? Would you turn down or allow the state not to get money from the federal government by continuing Governor Malloy's sanctuary city policies?
Well, I don't think that the position by the federal government to say they're going to take money away from other programs, state government, local government, is right. And the mayor, I was with the mayor of Chicago a little over a week ago, who has filed a lawsuit on Chicago's behalf against the federal administration. We've taken a position rather than be combative over terminology, what we've declared Bridgeport is a welcoming city. Our city council has done that. They've put into place a resolution that emphasizes the importance of being welcoming, about protecting all of our citizens.
Will your officers respond to a detainer request from the federal government if there's a nonviolent person in the lockup whom you would otherwise release?
Yeah, on that, I mean, you gave a really specific example.
But that's where the rubber meets the road.
Yeah, I don't know. Whatever the law is, our chief has said that, we're not going to violate. Nobody's going to violate.
But that's why Chicago and New Haven might lose money and other cities wouldn't.
I'm not clear. It's not clear to me on whether it's the terminology of sanctuary cities and where you say the rubber
hits
the road.
There is no legal term at all. Right, that's going to be the basis of a lot of these lawsuits like Rahm Emanuel's, is that their feeling has not been defined enough. The federal government says we've defined it as cooperating with these detainer requests.
Yeah, well, Chicago actually declared themselves, I think, a welcoming city as well. I don't think he used the term sanctuary.
So you're saying you can welcome immigrants without having to be specific in your policies in a way that would jeopardize the money?
No, I think the policies are, well, nobody wants to jeopardize money, because public money to serve the people of the city of Bridgeport, for instance, or the people of the state of Connecticut is important. We have an obligation to, as public officials, to do all that we can to provide the greatest degree of support we could. So to be reckless in terminology, I don't think makes good public policy.
There was some protest at the Fairfield train station. What was that about? People from Fairfield came to Bridgeport, right, and were protesting your immigration policy?
Right. There was someone who said, make Bridgeport a sanctuary city, quote unquote. And we said, well, make Fairfield a sanctuary city.
So you actually went to Fairfield with a picket sign, right?
Right. Because, this is like, wait a minute. Oh, either we're in this together. Let's bridge the gap between, an imaginary border. If we're going to, whatever we're going to do, it's part of the idea. It was a little bit of, this for that. But when you get beyond that, the point was made. We're going to do this together. And as much as we pushed back, immediately said, look, let's work with our surrounding towns and let's do the things. And that's happening, actually. Some of the individuals that were there are actually helping me and being supportive of some of the needs that are met. We actually welcomed the last Syrian refugee family that came into the United States, that came into Connecticut, into Bridgeport. I personally did that to let people know that despite the battle over terminology and some of that back and forth, this was a welcoming city. I went out of my way. We met them at the International Institute.
When did your family first come to the U.S.? What generation?
My grandparents came a little over 100 years ago.
From?
Well, I have my father's parents, my grandparents on my father's side are from Lebanon. My mothers are from Syria, my grandfather, wow, and Italy. So I have three ethnicities in four grandparents.
Isn't that part of what Bridgeport's about? Like, you grew up
absolutely
in Bridgeport.
And Bridgeport is a
melting
pot.
Were you aware of Armenian, Syrian, Lebanese, and Italian roots? Was that actually a part of your life growing up?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Tell me about that.
It was, although there's not... So with the Lebanese community, for instance, or Middle East and Lebanese and Syrian to a certain extent, the communities, the larger communities, are actually in cities like Danbury, where I was last week, and Waterbury. Those are the larger communities. All Bridgeport has... We do have a number. Those are where the greater communities and the churches are. So a lot of these communities, as you know, generations back, were centered around the churches, and regardless of ethnicity. So, but we had that growing up, absolutely, and Italian as well. And the Bridgeport has a very large Italian population. I think it's the largest ethnic group.
As does New Haven, and we've been seeing you in New Haven.
Yeah, I love New Haven.
Are you hoping New Haven's going to be a big part of your campaign for governor? How important are we going to be in your...
I think it is critically important and natural for us as cities to be on the same agenda, on the same path, and what's going to be, I believe.
You were at the Greek Olive, you were at the Democratic Town Convention.
Absolutely.
You were at everything. Who's backing in New Haven? I know Reverend Kimber has been...
Well, we've been friends for years. He counseled me even through my difficult times and so on. And I've got a lot of people that are been supportive and are supportive.
Who are some of the other folks on the ground you got in New Haven?
Well, I don't know if they'd be names necessarily that you would know, although...
I know some people in New Haven.
Well, I've become very friendly with the vice chair of the Democratic Party. I'm, of course, friendly with the chairman. I have great respect for the mayor. I think she's doing a tremendous job. And she's out front on important issues for New Haven and things that play well around this and are important for people around the state. Waterbury, the same thing. Hartford, outreach into Hartford. I think there's a real element of our cities coming together and having a say in the direction of Connecticut through this next election, and having an impact to improve the quality of life for people in our cities and towns all across.
Well, Joe Ganim, I look forward to seeing you in New Haven a lot over
my
the
pleasure.
Next year.
Thank you
half.
For having me.
Thank you so much, Joe Ganim, for joining us on Dateline New Haven at WNHH-FM. And there's a lot more we could have talked about. I hope we have a chance again.
We will, I hope.
And it was a real pleasure to talk to you in person. And thank you for joining us today. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free from their CD, A Plea for Peace. Now, we know what it's like to be free. We just got to book our flight. Book your flight with us here every day and night at WNHH Radio, your home for community radio.